In my younger years, I wasn't too fond of classical music. I liked mostly British popular music. Then in 1984, I fell in love with the music of Mozart. It was all because of a movie, Amadeus. I'm sure that many of you have seen it and remember it. It's a movie that won 8 Oscar awards. A movie about the life, the music, the ups and downs, the tragedy of Mozart's life. And interestingly, the title of the movie is Amadeus, the middle name of Wolfgang Mozart, because Amadeus means loved by God, God's friend. And indeed, Mozart was blessed by God. He had a great gift for music. However, Mozart lived a disorderly moral life. He squandered his wealth. He composed operas with dubious content, like Così fan tutte, or Don Giovanni, or the Wedding of Figaro. You know, they were considered, rated R operas, so to speak, in those days. Most of all, Mozart displeased his father, Leopold. Leopold was really upset at his son. Leopold was a man of great righteousness and rectitude of life. So when Leopold finally died, Mozart, the son, was filled with regrets, with a sense of guilt, and also with fear of God's punishment. He began composing his, to me, masterpiece, the Requiem Mass, the Mass for the funeral. He was going to dedicate it to his father. He left it unfinished. But in this Mass, there is a hymn to Christ the King, and that's why I'm telling you this story. There's a song, a hymn, that is dedicated to the King of Tremendous Majesty. This is actually the title of this movement of the Requiem Mass. And I would like for you now to listen to just the first measures of this music and perceive in it the theology of the time, how Jesus' majesty, his kingliness, was a reason of great awe and fear of the Lord. So listen for a moment to these few notes. Rex tremende majestatis. These are the three words that open this movement. King of tremendous majesty. Imagine this music played live by an orchestra and a choir for a funeral mass. It would fill you with wonder and awe, with trembling and fear of the Lord. Celebrating Christ the King, the judge of the universe, who will sit on his throne to judge everyone at the end of time, filled the people, filled the church, filled Mozart with fear. Now, is this the inner disposition, the spiritual mood that we should also have in this solemnity of Christ the King? Well, our sensitivity has certainly changed. We tend to dismiss an image of a terrifying God who will judge the world with severity at the end of time. And the teaching of the popes and the councils of the Vatican Council and all the documents of the church lately, and even the sensus fidei, the sense of faith of the church, goes toward instead a more merciful God, a God who is tender and loving. Still, I believe we should not dismiss these feelings of wonder and awe in the presence of Christ the King. This is very biblical, by the way. The God in the Bible was called El Shaddai, the omnipotent, the God Sabaoth, the God of armies. Moses did not dare to lift his eyes to see the face of God, lest he would die. Just being in the presence of God would be a terrifying experience. His majesty, infinite, omnipotent, eternal, all-powerful. Knowing this and having it firmly at heart will not only keep us personally in a right relationship with him, I think it will also scale down the absurd claims to absolute power of any totalitarian regime up and down the centuries, any tyranny or dictatorship abrogating absolute servitude and obedience. Only God deserves our total obedience, our submission and devotion. This, by the way, is the reason why the solemnity of Christ the King was established not even 100 years ago. It's a very recent feast or solemnity, considering that most of the others are 2,000 years old. It was established by Pope Pius XI in 1925. Of course, belief in Jesus' kingship goes back 2,000 years. He was called, after all, the Lord, Kyrios, a title that was reserved to the Caesar, to the emperor. But Christians gave that title to Jesus, the Christ, the Lord. However, Pius XI wanted to establish that solemnity at that specific moment because of the context, the social, political context of the time. 1925. In 1925, the world has just finished the First World War, the worst and most violent war in the history of humanity to that date. In my country, in Italy, Mussolini had already marched on Rome in 1922 and risen to power as the Duce, the undisputed leader or fascist party and the government. It was not per se an anti-Christian ideology, but it demanded total obedience, absolute power to the regime, and by doing so, it was indeed a form of idolatry. The same goes for Nazism in Germany. Hitler had already become chief of the Nazis' party in 1921. And in 1925, the day of the year when the feast of Christ the King was established, he published his manifesto, Mein Kampf. In Russia, the Bolshevik Revolution had taken place in 1917. And established an atheist communist regime. God was violently and arrogantly removed from society. In Mexico, the new Masonic anti-clerical constitution of 1917 was now being enforced by the president, Plutarco Calle, abolishing any expression of religion. There was a war, the Cristero or Cristiada War, where many good Catholics defended their right to worship, the right of faith, and over 90,000 were put to death. Many are already canonized as martyrs. One was canonized almost a year ago, just a year ago, José Luis Sánchez del Río. He died at 14 years old. So this was the context, this historical context. And Pope Pius XI recognized in this historical context of totalitarian regimes, of extreme ideologies, a real danger of idolatry that took God out of society and replaced it with the authority of governments, despots, tyrants. The Pope made it clear, if God is not the center of our life, the ultimate authority to whom we owe obedience, if he is not the king of the universe, great evil will break loose. And it did, because the last century was the most violent of all human history. All evil, genocides, cruelty took place in that century. Now, the message of the Bible is clear. Only God is God. The Lord is God alone. Only God has absolute power, deserves absolute obedience. Let me say it. Religion is not a democracy. I'll say it again. Religion is not a democracy. We don't take up opinion polls to decide who God is, what his plan should be, what salvation should look like. No, it's not a democracy. We do have a deeply democratic sensibility, and rightly so. It's a good thing, because democracy is the best system of government. And it's a system that intends precisely to hold off any claim to absolute or king-like authority. We would not accept that. Yet, in the spiritual realm, there is no democracy. Only God is God. His absolute authority demands absolute devotion and obedience. Jesus has revealed that God is love. So his absolute power is the power of love. So the obedience we owe to him also is love. When we love concretely and indeed, when we do the works of mercy, taking care of the least of our brothers and giving them food, a drink to those who are thirsty, clothing to the naked, welcoming the stranger, caring for the sick and visiting the imprisoned, when we do that, we honor Christ as our King. Mother Teresa summarized the whole gospel in five words. She said, the gospel in one hand, you did it to me. You did it to me. That's the gospel in one hand. When you do that, you are honoring Christ the King. Let me close now with a little story written by Father John Powell, a Jesuit priest, in a book titled The Christian Vision. He tells of an old Irish legend. The king, the reigning king, had no children to succeed him on the throne. So he had his messengers post signs in every town and village of his kingdom, inviting qualified young men to apply for an interview with the king to see if he could be chosen as the successor. Two qualifications were needed. The person must have deep love for God and love for his neighbor. One young man saw one of the signs. His neighbors invited him, encouraged him to apply. They told him, you are a good man, you love God, you love your neighbor. Indeed, he was a good person. But he was so poor he had no money to buy decent clothes to wear for an interview with the king, and no money to buy enough provisions for the long journey. They helped him. The community begged everywhere for money until they were able to send him to that interview with the king. They bought nice clothes and gave him the provisions he needed. When everything was ready, he set out. After almost a month of travel, he caught sight of the king's castle. But just about at the same time, he also saw a poor old beggar sitting by the side of the road. The beggar held out his hands and pleaded for help. "I am hungry. I'm cold," he said in a shivering voice. "Could you please give me something to eat, something to keep me warm?" The young man was moved by the sight of the beggar. He stripped off his warm outer clothes and exchanged them for the tattered old coat of the beggar. He also gave the beggar all of his provisions. That then, somewhat uncomfortably, I guess, he walked to the castle for the interview. When he arrived at the castle, the guards took him to the visitors' area. After a long wait, he was led to see the king. He bowed down before the throne, and when he finally straightened up, he could hardly believe his eyes. He said to the king, "But you are the beggar, the old man by the side of the road." "That's right," said the king. "I had to find out if you really loved God and your neighbor. What you did for that beggar, you did it to me." The gospel in one hand. "You did it to me." Amen.